Chapter 5. Back Orifice. Peter Mudge Zatko arrived at Boston's Berklee College of Music in 1988 to study guitar composition and performance. It was either that or go study technology somewhere else. And back then, computer science departments weren't teaching what he was interested in, how things really worked, as opposed to how they were supposed to work. But his classes during the day were not going to present much of an obstacle to learning what he wanted. Mudge already knew a great deal from experimenting and from the bulletin boards he had been on for years, where he had met Dan McMillan and others. Once he moved up to Boston from his father's place in Pennsylvania, Mudge also found the 2600 gatherings and discovered that MIT students were just as interested in using Berklee's recording studios as he was in using MIT's lab computers. Bartering solved both problems neatly. Mudge stood out in many respects, even from oddball hackers. He grew up in the deepest South, where his father David taught sophisticated chemistry at the University of Alabama, and he was a full-fledged musical prodigy. His parents started him off carrying a cigar box under his chin at 2 1/2, Mudge said, to get him used to putting a violin there. By the time he got to Berklee, he was practicing 5 hours a day, a routine he compared to the grueling training of Chinese acrobats. But he was never just about music. David Zatko worked on the government's space shuttle efforts and brought home computer parts to his toddler. With a $5,000 bequest from Mudge's grandfather, the middle-class family bought an Apple II Plus, intending it to be educational. That it was, especially because a nearby store offered software that the buyer could return quickly for a partial refund. That made cracking the copy protection an imperative for Mudge and his father. And it was an early lesson in perverse incentives, a subject that Mudge would one day find himself debating in the Pentagon. Breaking the rights management on Apple software in games like Ultima 4 was our jigsaw puzzle, Mudge said. We did that, and we picked locks. Before the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act of 1986, and especially before war games made open networks into overcrowded playgrounds, Mudge roamed far from home. His custom when entering a company's network was to leave a message announcing himself. Sometimes the administrator would bark at him to leave. Other times, employees would ask him to avoid a certain area. But most often, no one complained. Given Mudge's attitude, his skills, and the LOD and MOD members he hung around with, many of his friends believed Mudge did other things that would be harder to defend in the light of day. Officially, he denies having broken the law, even by uploading pirated software to the trading sites he visited. He admits only that he got unwanted attention from the authorities due to his explorations. Others who might know differently could have a tough time proving it was really Mudge they were dealing with. When it came time to fill out forms to apply for a U.S. government security clearance, Mudge's list of aliases ran for 10 pages. Obviously, Mudge had been up to something. So much so, he joked that when the Chinese stole his and millions of others' people's SF-86 security clearance applications in 2015, they must have thought they were being trolled. No one with his history could have gotten a clearance. To remind him of the risks of overstepping, Mudge kept a picture above his computers of his friend Byron York, known as Lou Cipher, getting arrested in Texas. Mudge had met York through Dan McMillan and Jesse Dryden. To Mudge, he was a nice guy who had been through a lot. In the picture, York was face down on the grass, a cop's knee on his back. The picture also served to prod Mudge about discretion. At HoHoCon 92, when he was out on bail, York had told his fellow hackers that he had been set up by a full-time informant who preyed on his circle after one of them admitted to crimes during a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He badgered us for about 6 months until we finally said okay, allegedly, to a scheme counterfeiting government checks, York had said. Entrapment doesn't apply because he's not law enforcement. The snitch was in the background of the arrest photograph, unmolested. The picture changed offices every time Mudge did, a constant reminder to never lose track of my moral compass and why I was doing everything, and that it would require constant vigilance to do so, Mudge said. He developed his own ethical code. He cared about information. He didn't care who he got it from, including criminals, and he was generous about sharing it, including with government officials. But he would never name names. After Mudge moved to Pennsylvania as a child, his parents' bitter divorce left him in control of his own hours. He convinced a suburban public high school that he was an emancipated minor and could excuse his own absences. Mudge preferred to hang around older musicians and hackers, including Robert Osband and others he met through TAP. Then came Boston and meeting his fellow hackers in Harvard Square. And after college, a trainee slot at BBN Technologies, working with people who helped build the internet. The long-haired Mudge started out on a temporary tech support job in the supercomputer department, with the promise that he could stay on in another division if it agreed to take him. Instead, he signed on to create the security department. By that point, he had already gotten Dan a job at a different computer company. Over the coming years, he would help Brian Hasek, Chris Weissopel, and several others land jobs at BBN. Dan took Mudge to visit the loft in 1994, and 2 years later, as the consumer internet was taking over the outside world, he joined. Around that time, the group was moving to a bigger space in a warehouse in Watertown. Mudge immediately started spinning ideas about making the loft more sustainable. Instead of just a clubhouse, he thought, it could be a research lab. They could make security tools and sell them, using the money to keep hacking. Eventually, if all went well, they could quit their day jobs and hack whatever struck their fancy. There was one hitch, the existing member said. CDC's John Lester, known as Count Zero. He wasn't interested in turning their hobby into a business, and he felt it would fundamentally change the chemistry of the loft. One night, while everyone was together but John, they sent a cowardly email from Loft co-founder Hasek's account asking John not to join them in Watertown. At a follow-up dinner with him to discuss it, Mudge did most of the hard talking. His role in John's departure cemented Mudge's new position as Loft frontman. Newly incorporated as Loft Heavy Industries, the group began releasing tools, including one that originated at Mudge's day job. He was used to Unix, but BBN was bringing in Windows machines, and Mudge had to handle security on those as well. Looking to test the strength of user passwords, he discovered that Microsoft was chopping up long and strong passwords into two fields of 7 characters each, making them far easier to crack. He wrote a guessing tool and asked BBN if they wanted to do anything with it. But the program had a casual, homemade feel to it, and BBN declined. So Mudge brought it home to the loft, which put it out as Loft Crack. Weissopel wrote a second version, adding a graphic user interface, and the loft began charging a small amount for it. The loft also released a series of security advisories, warning the public of flaws in a range of software, including Sendmail, Lotus Domino, and Microsoft's IIS web server. Security consultants took note, and customers complained, forcing the product makers to issue fixes. The advisories drew the first wide attention to the loft, and within the industry, it crystallized a debate that had been raging behind closed doors for years. Many companies argued it was irresponsible to tell people about flaws in the private software they sold because it taught hackers how to break into customers' machines. In some cases, software producers even sued researchers for evading the protections on programs they had purchased in order to look inside. But when hackers told only companies of the flaws, the software makers usually ignored them. The only way to actually force things to get fixed was to expose the information. Given what Mudge had accomplished at the loft, Misha Kubeka and Dan McMillan lobbied Kevin to bring Mudge into CDC as well in 1996. Mudge is someone to be reckoned with, and it's a good idea to have him in our camp, Misha wrote to the group mailing list. The others had the impression that among his other qualifications, Mudge had hacked other security luminaries. But Mudge generally let people think he did more hands-on hacking than he did. At BBN, he had free rein over everything the company supported, including military and financial systems. That made random break-ins elsewhere less tempting. Once, a leading security figure came to the loft, and Mudge asked him why the White House email monitoring system the visitor had built had been configured in a certain way. Mid-answer, the guest realized that Mudge had to have been inside that system to know enough to ask the question, and he said as much. Others present assumed that Mudge had hacked the White House, though actually, he had been authorized to examine the design on behalf of BBN. At the loft, Mudge also acted as a defender. He did install a backdoor on the Unix servers to make sure they weren't misused, or at least not much, by guests. But outside his home turf, different rules applied. Mudge wrote exploits and gave them away to defenders and attackers alike. I would give certain teams, groups, and people early access to some of my software and tools. Sometimes tools that were a bit too powerful and purpose-built for me to release them publicly, Mudge said. Sometimes those attackers would give him back tribute, including priceless code for major operating systems. Mudge did not ask for those goods or trade for them. And though in theory he could still have been charged with receiving stolen goods, he was not. The bartering system back then for actual hackers and folk were these tarballs of proprietary source code, personal or private information. New tools were sometimes viewed as more valuable. So I was looked at as a real heavyweight, Mudge said. It was important for me to be viewed as sharing with the community because I believed in it. And yes, there are parts of the community that were obviously doing illegal things. That wasn't my focus, nor my goal. I wanted to inspire more people to release novel tools and applied research so we could understand and fix the cyber world that was being erected around us. Though there was enthusiasm for Mudge from the Bostonians, Jesse, and others, Kevin had final say over all new members, and it was going to be awkward because John Lester was already a member. But Mudge would cement the group's transformation from self-publishing pranksters to actual authorities on security. Kevin made the deal. Mudge got something from the marriage as well. He wanted to make a dent in the universe, he said. A hacker's hacker, he wanted to tear things apart and find out how things really functioned, then either explain them, or if possible, put them back together better than they had been. He applied the same mindset to other aspects of the world, the computer industry as a whole, politics, and the media. The mainstream media was evolving as the web gave so many others a voice, but it was still a dominant and mysterious force in the world. How did it decide what was true, and which truths were more important? How did other factors come into play, like the sex appeal of a story, potential audience size, and the pursuit of the greater good? CDC had been moving into a phase of culture jamming, playing with the media as the group became better known. Mysterious criminals messing with not just strangers' home computers, but NORAD's mainframe made for great copy. And CDC had decided to help explain things at whatever level the reporter was at. If reporters asked serious questions, they would get serious answers. If a clueless TV correspondent just wanted to hype something as scary, CDC would accommodate that too. The group realized that coverage led to more coverage, especially when so many knew so little about computers. In the right vacuum, a group like CDC can flourish. That's their talent, said the Works founder Jason Sadovsky. Kevin, the self-described hype man, had been thinking about the distribution of text files when most people were not. Now there were cameras showing up, and CDC had some credibility. And they ran to the cameras. Sadovsky said, "Here we are. We're hackers." Mudge saw a chance to learn. The experiment was, how easy is it to manipulate the press and the media? And this is actually fairly relevant right now. Mudge said in 2018, "If we say something, will it actually be repeated? They would jam information to see how far out it would go." I thought it was fascinating. It made me look at the media in a different way. I started to understand the incentive structures and the restraints on resources. Mudge took what he learned and applied it back at the Loft, which shared some members with CDC and was working on similar problems, but which was treated more respectfully by reporters and TV crews. He got to play both good cop and bad cop in the security world. Though the arrival of the ubiquitous web in 1995 killed off most bulletin boards, CDC managed the transition because of its expanding cast of actual security experts and its physical base at the Loft. Just surviving was half the battle. Once it did that, CDC's history made people turn to it when they wanted to know where internet culture was coming from, what the web meant, and how secure it all was. Those who stumbled onto CDC then touted it to others. It was a real resource, but it was also an inside joke turned pro. The media, of course, were hardest pressed to explain the web, and they came early and often. When they searched pre-Google for news about hackers, they would find Luke Benfey's 1994 Dateline interview or Geraldo's Computer Vice episode, which somehow linked up everything bad and trashy, from serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer having a modem to the 1988 CDC text file, Sex with Satan. Geraldo called CDC a bunch of sickos. CDC itself touted that, and all the other media notices, realizing that journalists would play it safe by calling the same sources that had already been broadcast. Insiders like Boing Boing zine editor Mark Frauenfelder promoted CDC, and the reasonably well-researched 1995 movie Hackers with Angelina Jolie showed CDC stickers in the background. Some of the time, the media's vague awareness that CDC was about hacking, which was bad, led to bizarre pronouncements. A 1996 story in the San Antonio Express News about the local Air Force Cyber Operations Center, for example, hilariously led to the assertion that the unit defends the nation's secrets from the members of the Legion of Doom and the Cult of the Dead Cow in a battlefield that spans the globe. Midwesterner Paul Leonard announced an explicit CDC culture jamming project called CDC Paramedia in August 1996, with the object of world domination through media saturation. Misha, Kevin, and Luke were enthusiasts of the effort, Luke adopting the title Minister of Propaganda. 2 weeks after the Paramedia announcement, the group wrote, "We intend to dominate and subvert the media wherever possible. Information is a virus, and we intend to infect all of you." Misha cheerfully wrote on the group site, "We're a neo-Marxist anarcho-socialist guerrilla unit forged for the sole purpose of getting on TV." The group considered what it was doing to be performance art. Back then, the truth didn't seem as endangered as it does now. So muddying the waters for a cause struck them as ethically acceptable. It's one thing if you have a state sponsor of disinformation and propaganda that is trying to affect a particular political outcome versus trying to raise consciousness of some issue that might not break through otherwise, said one member of CDC. The circumstances matter. At the time, the group considered getting rid of its old bomb-making recipes out of a sense of social responsibility. But Kevin voted with the majority against burying evidence of the anarchy period of the cyberpunk's progress, as he termed it in a group email. Instead, he suggested adding a disclaimer that would say, in part, "If you're smart enough to use a computer and seek out the CDC, then you should be smart enough not to screw around with something like a bomb recipe that is full of spelling and grammatical errors. If the author can't spell or punctuate properly, what the fuck makes you think he can describe how to build a bomb that won't kill you?" CDC became the first hacker group to issue press releases, and Misha compiled a list of email addresses for hundreds of journalists. Whimsically, Luke took advantage of improper access to various databases and sent printouts to an idiosyncratic list of celebrities as well, including Sean Connery, Harrison Ford, Uma Thurman, and Luke's favorite person, the muscled and campy A-team star known as Mr. T. Meanwhile, the group remained shadowy, using only handles in its communications and public speeches. CDC's open pursuit of attention struck many hackers as refreshingly candid at a time when other hackers were posing as criminal geniuses or visionaries. They were high-functioning tricksters, the media and their audiences the most common victims. A crowning achievement came after a Japanese television reporter complained that her producers had rejected her thoughtful piece on hackerdom because it lacked excitement. Wearing masks or sunglasses and trying to look scary, Luke and two others agreed to be interviewed on camera telling tall tales. They claimed to be able to divert both moving trains and satellites. They were the showmen of the industry, DEFCON founder Jeff Moss said of CDC. They were great at taking an issue and calling attention to it. As for truth-telling, Luke saw as his model the Yes Men, politically driven artists who say they use public spectacle to affect the public debate. As the Netscape browser and Microsoft's Windows 95 operating system brought the internet to the masses, the security issues that had previously been glaring to hackers suddenly put everyone at risk. The Loft might flag a few flaws out of thousands that experts could find at any time, but word of even those rarely reached the average computer user. Television commercials funded with venture capital and Microsoft's monopoly profits hyped the amazing online world. But no one had a strong financial incentive to point out the pitfalls. Almost none in the mainstream media covered security full-time, and those who dabbled were under pressure to write about the great advances in computing, which public relations people also pushed, not the complicated potential problems that their editors couldn't quite grasp. While CDC played with the media's gullibility, it was learning more about how it worked. The group was probing the press the same way it poked at software, and it gradually realized that the greatest threat to security was the poor distribution of true information. The best place for CDC to start fixing that was at DEF CON in Las Vegas. Luke spoke at the third DEF CON in 1995, giving a miniature course in media training. He retold the Dateline story, explaining that the correspondent had badgered him over whether he felt remorse and that he had learned a lot from the experience. For the most part, the media sucks, he warned. You very rarely see a positive or even accurate view of hackers through the media. Luke advocated sounding out journalists on their angles and declaring what was off limits. But engaging with serious ones could be worthwhile, he believed, because hackers were in the best position to speak through the media and tell people how to protect themselves and when companies were shipping software full of holes. Public voices were crucial for their kind, as well as for consumers, because politicians were weighing laws and enforcement choices that would decide whether hackers would have to stop exploring or face jail. Luke's talk at the 1995 DEF CON and other media appearances made him a bit of a celebrity among hackers, which made it easy to meet new people, many of whom wanted to join CDC. But CDC didn't want to be just a social club. That's where CDC's Ninja Strike Force came in. Sam Anthony had dreamed up the idea after taking kung fu classes and was the first leader of the auxiliary group. Terrible people were interested in joining CDC. Anthony said, CDC wanted to stay small, like the best invite-only bulletin boards. The compromise was keeping CDC elite, but expanding through the NSF. So Sam cribbed from a sneaker design, wrote a satiric origin story, and made t-shirts. Early members were people the group liked and respected, including Chris Weissopel, Window Snyder, pioneer maker Limor Fried, and early Apple and Netscape engineer Tom Dell, who had written software for MindVox and quietly ran Rotten.com, forerunner of the shock website 4chan. That year's DEF CON had drawn a then-record 300 people, and at 300 pounds, Luke was hard to miss. Oakland hacker Josh Bookbinder, who knew him only online, first spotted him in the flesh on the casino floor, holding a teenager upside down by his ankles and shaking him until the coins fell out of his pocket. The kid was so excited that after Luke set him down, he ran away squealing. Someone explained to Josh that it was considered a great honor to be shaken down by Death Vegetable. That night, Josh joined Luke and his friends to go off into the desert, take drugs, and shoot guns all night, Hunter S. Thompson style. In a minor miracle, no one was hurt. Josh stayed in touch with CDC members over the next 2 years as his skills improved. And in 1997, Dan McMillan sponsored him for admission to CDC as Sir Distic. Josh was attending junior college by then after dropping out of high school. He felt behind the curve technologically. Since his Bay Area friends were all playing around with Linux, the breakthrough free and open source operating system that was challenging Microsoft inside big company server rooms. When Microsoft came out with versions of Windows that could handle internet connections, Josh poked at it. Though his friends thought Windows so inferior as to be uninteresting, Josh figured that enough regular people would end up using it that any research would be worthwhile. What he saw was horrifying. There was essentially no security at all. Anyone who used a Windows machine to read email or browse the web could easily lose control of his or her machine to a stranger. Just about any kind of software would run on the system, and it could be made invisible to the user by those who knew what they were doing. All a user had to do to be infected was click on a file with an innocuous name. Josh was far from alone in raising the alarm at Microsoft's head-in-the-sand approach. Chris Tucker sent a draft of a rant to the CDC mailing list in 1997, declaring Microsoft is evil because they sell crap that only has a chance of getting fixed in a future version if enough people call Microsoft to complain. You stupid fucks pay Bill Gates to beta test his crappy software, Chris wrote. The problem was compounded because Microsoft sold to a handful of computer makers, not the end users, and Microsoft held all the power in those relationships. Josh knew he could write a program that would prove the point, that would give invisible control to an email correspondent or anyone else who could establish a connection. He could use such a tool himself to spy or to steal. But that would break the 1986 hacking law while not being all that much fun. Releasing it into the wild, on the other hand, with as much fanfare as possible, would force Microsoft to admit it had a problem and do something to protect its customers. As it stood, selling Windows 95 and 98 was like giving loaded guns to children, Josh said. My point was if we can do this, anybody can. They needed to take this seriously. Plus, with the help from the media, it would be damn funny to watch. He emailed the CDC list and asked what the other members thought of the idea. Carrie Campbell was opposed to it. She had moved from technical writing to running an internet access provider and now lived near Microsoft's main campus, where she had many friends. Beyond that, she knew that the program would give new power to thousands of relatively unskilled script kiddies. She saw the public service argument. She just felt the likely side effects outweighed it. It's going to hurt average people, Carrie told them. But she was in the minority. The others gave Josh all the encouragement he needed. Just to make sure he wouldn't get slapped and handcuffed simply for writing a malicious program, Josh picked up the phone and called the local FBI office. He asked for an agent in the criminal division. Would I be in trouble if I released a program that others could use to hack people? He asked. You'll have to ask a lawyer that, the agent responded. Josh would not be deterred. No, you're the FBI, he said. Would you arrest someone who did that or not? The agent asked him to hang on. After a while, he picked up the line again. We would really rather you not do this, he told the hacker. But it's not technically illegal. Josh checked one last time to be sure. So I'm good? He asked. You're good, the agent sighed. Then came the hard work. More than a year of prodding for undocumented programming interfaces, the hooks that allowed programs to run on top of Windows. Josh had never written anything remotely that ambitious, but he knew it was possible. He thought Microsoft security bordered on the criminally incompetent, and he wanted to impress Mudge and his other new friends in CDC. He smoked a prodigious amount of marijuana and kept hammering away through trial and error. By 1998, Josh was getting a fair amount of encouragement in person. Misha had moved to San Francisco in 1992 and had bragged about it to Luke and the others back east at every opportunity. One of Misha's first contacts was the editor of a magazine called Mondo 2000, who reprinted his Information America piece and introduced him to her boyfriend Eric Hughes, who was about to start the Cyberpunk's mailing list hosted by John Gilmore. Misha spread the word among hackers. The dot-com boom that began with Netscape's initial public offering in 1995 lured more waves of CDC members and friends to California. Dylan Shea took a job at the Mountain View headquarters of Netscape itself in 1996, and when the company offered to pay for his move, he brought out Luke's gear as well. Luke recreated the non-resident part of his Austin hacker group home, New Hack City, in San Francisco, turning CDC into a bi-coastal operation. First came a hacker space in an old can factory on the border of Dogpatch, a rundown bit of the city. Then came a spot at Market Street and 6th Street, so rough that Luke once caught a woman hiding behind his bulk to smoke crack on the sidewalk. The label on the apartment directory said C-Tech Astronomy, a nod to the hacker movie Sneakers, and an anagram for Too Many Secrets. At one open house, someone not in on the joke asked why astronomers would be in a basement apartment. CDC believed that Microsoft's response to Josh's program would be directly proportional to the amount of noise it made. So with its greater understanding of the media, CDC wasted no time in building interest in what it had dubbed back orifice, a crude pun on Microsoft's back office software. It explained in writing what the program could do well ahead of the actual release, which was planned for the biggest DEF CON yet in 1998. It was up to the hacker how to install the program on a target machine, but it could be combined with any desired executable program, like a word processor or calculator, and emailed to the intended victim. Luke's press release called out features that could log keystrokes on the target computer and encrypt traffic to the hacker who had sent the program. Other software writers could add modules for still more functions. CDC did not advertise the fact that it had taken mercy on Microsoft and the young antivirus industry by setting the default port for inbound traffic as 31337. Hackers speak for E-L-E-E-T, that is, elite. All anyone had to do to stop off-the-shelf installations by non-coders was block traffic to that port. Luke coordinated major stories with Wired and other publications, while Kevin and others concentrated on making the DEF CON presentation as theatrical as possible. During the Saturday afternoon peak of the three-day con, Kevin and Dylan invented some last-minute gimmicks just before the start of the 4:15 p.m. panel. Acerdistic, Josh then went on stage and droned a few boring sentences. A planted heckler, yelling that back orifice was a hoax, ran to the stage and grabbed the mic. Luke charged at the man and hoisted him off stage. Then the rest of the CDC crew rushed on. Bringing up the rear was Kevin, with a t-shirt reading Grandmaster Rate, a thick chain around his neck, and white rabbit fur chaps over his jeans. He jumped on the table and started rapping about CDC. "I can feel the love in the room," he shouted. "We love our people!" Then he whipped the crowd into a call and response, "When I say dead, you say cow. Dead, cow." Kevin handed the mic to Sam Anthony, who sounded calmer. But Sam wore a stocking hat pulled over his face, showing a cow skull, and he was explicit about asking the recipients of back orifice to hack, and to hack for a cause. "We want you to give back to CDC," he explained. "We are making it so easy that an 8-year-old can make a difference. can fuck shit up. After Carrie said a few words, Josh took over and ran through the functions, drawing applause when he showed it popping up a Windows dialog box with wording of his choice. He took questions, and at the end of the group, threw CDs with the program to the crowd. Afterward, Josh did his pre-approved interviews with Businessweek, CNN, NPR, and the BBC, all of whom were stunned that he wouldn't give his real name. USA Today and dozens of others ran stories in the next day and a half. The New York Times, which had already mentioned CDC in a broader DEFCON piece, returned with an article on back orifice alone, noting in the second paragraph that CDC said it was trying to get Microsoft to focus on security. It also outed Josh as sadistic. Nothing like this had ever happened before. At the then height of public concern about hacking, at the top conference on the subject, the best-known hacking group had given out a major tool for free. At least in the short term, it certainly seemed like there was going to be much more hacking as a result. They pulled this joke off on the most dominant commercial force in the world, said Jason Sadowski. They wanted to get on TV, and they got on TV. Yet instead of sounding the alarm or calling for a renewed joint effort to stop hacking or make software safer, Microsoft gave the public impression that it had barely noticed what happened in Las Vegas. This is not a tool we should take seriously, or our customers should take seriously, Microsoft marketer Edmund Muth told the New York Times. The company argued that there were no new vulnerabilities involved in BackOrifice, but that claim was aimed at the uneducated and the media. If BackOrifice had relied on newly discovered holes in Windows or other Microsoft software, the company would have patched them in an update, and the exposure would have been confined to those who did not patch. Instead, the issue was the essential architecture of Windows. The contrast between what Microsoft was saying and what the more articulate hackers were saying was jarring, and it forced many people to think harder about serious issues for the first time. While Microsoft is fully buzzword compliant, Mudge told one interviewer, it only recently had established a security response team and came off to technical people like the town drunk. It's almost unfair to continually beat up on them because they can't really defend themselves. Within months, people had downloaded BackOrifice hundreds of thousands of times just from the CDC website, with an unknown number of pirated versions circulating as well. Many thousands of innocent people fell victim. After internet service provider Mindspring complained that it was detecting at least two new infections of its customers each day, the local Atlanta field office of the FBI opened a criminal hacking conspiracy investigation into CDC and Luke personally, centered on the theory that infected machines were sending stolen data back to servers under CDC control. Because they were doing no such thing, the case sputtered before its formal closure in 2003. Hackers were also among the victims. If they popped a CD with the program into their machines, then read the instructions, they could safely download the virus and begin thinking about sending it to a victim, unless they had set up their machines to automatically play any CD inserted, in which case they immediately infected themselves. Both fan and hate mail flowed into CDC. One supportive message came from porn star Brandy Alexander, who said someone had hacked an adult film industry journalist who used the pen name Luke Ford and deleted files. "Glory be to the dead cow on high," she emailed, explaining that Ford punished stars by revealing their legal names. "I am your slave if you should happen to repeatedly attack his real names list," she wrote. "What may I do in return, master?" CDC got fan mail from the mothers of teenagers, an NSA staffer, British writer Neil Gaiman, and an actor from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. But it wasn't all roses. Josh also got anonymous death threats. Inside Microsoft, BackOrifice became the company's biggest security headache by far. When the press realized that back orifice was big and the company had no defense, Microsoft came back with a new message. While there was still nothing to worry about, those who were absolutely convinced that they needed the very best security could buy Microsoft's forthcoming completely re-engineered operating system designed for networked machines, Windows NT. That system, Microsoft said, offered a comprehensive set of security features that make it the best choice for business users' mission-critical applications. For all of the planning that had gone into Backorifice, the group was shocked by how big it blew up. A much larger number of people now saw that hacking was a clear and present danger, which was great. But Microsoft's bogus response was still holding the line inside most of its big customers. The businesses had no right to sue over software, since the event when a program changes hands was not classified by the courts as a sale. Well-funded industry lawyers had convinced multiple judges that the electronic terms of service that ended with clicks on "I agree" were for licensing deals. There was no liability for a faulty product under the law because there had been no sale. The only remedy was to cancel the license, and that was a dead end. Though Linux was fine for heavy loads, there were few alternatives to Word and Excel for regular office workers. The more time that went by, the angrier CDC members got. Even Carrie, who hadn't initially supported Backorifice, agreed it was ridiculous that Microsoft still had its head in the sand after being shown its vulnerabilities. CDC turned to one of its newest and smartest members, Christian Ryu, to take on Windows NT and prove that the group was not a one-hit wonder that had been steamrolled by Microsoft's marketing department. This time, Carrie was all for it. They were like the dog that caught a car. They could have stopped, Sadovsky said. But somehow they got in and drove the car and said, "Let's see where this goes." Chapter 6. $1 million and a monster truck. As the loft and the cult of the dead cow attracted more technologically advanced members, some of the earlier guiding forces faded to the background. Fringe culture fan and CDC co-founder Bill Brown stayed loosely in touch through art college and as he began working on experimental documentary films, some of which landed in major museums. Then he saw CDC become part of the mainstream news. Good for society, he figured, but less of a fit for him. It is exactly when CDC becomes interesting that I became less interested in it, Bill said. CDC now included the elite of the hacking world, even though its earliest text files had mocked such people as exclusionary showboats. It became more and more like the thing it was supposed to be pranking about. Kevin Wheeler sympathized. As the group discussed possible new members in 1999, he lamented, "These guys are all tech guys. Where's the CDC skateboarding team? Why are there no porn stars in CDC? No guys into scary militias in a compound in Montana? Why are we 95% white males?" It was true. CDC was getting less countercultural and less strange. The new tech talent attracted more like themselves, highly educated, curious technologists with a skeptical view of the world. The final crossover member of both The Loft and CDC was especially that. Christian Ryu's father was a musicology professor in Lewiston, Maine, who brought home programming books as he grappled with software for processing music. Like Mudge, Christian learned to break protections around the childhood computer games in order to keep playing them. The family moved to Monmouth to get Christian into a public school program for gifted kids. Even so, he skipped eighth grade and spent his senior year of high school at Bates College. Bates had access to Internet Relay Chat and Usenet, and he found CDC text files there in 1992. He was admitted to MIT in 1994 at age 16 on a full scholarship. For someone who had always been the cleverest kid around and had never been to Boston, Christian had a lot to take in. Academically, Christian appreciated that MIT had stopped issuing grades to freshmen after too many suicides. There were parties with other bright kids every Friday, and the newcomer became social chair of his frat. Christian also took responsibility for connecting the frat to the university network, and he closely tracked how the net was developing. He was thinking of himself as a computer game programmer when he read papers by Mudge and others about finding software flaws that could be exploited, and he became entranced with the idea. Among the more promising classes of screw-ups in programming was a failure to stop what were called buffer overflows. If the coder did not properly limit the amount of data that could be taken into a buffered area of memory, a hacker could enter too much and overflow it, making the excess data delete something in nearby storage. In some cases, that would allow the hacker to take control of the machine. Buffer overflows had been found in a number of high-performance systems, though not the early versions of Windows. Christian found an overflow in Internet Explorer 4, the browser that Microsoft improperly bundled with Windows in 1997 in order to beat pioneer Netscape. Christian excitedly wrote up his finding for 2600, which declined to publish it. So he took his printouts to his 2600 meeting at the Prudential Center, hoping to impress the Loft guys. It worked, and they published an advisory about IE4 under Christian's new handle, Dildog, after the Dilbert Comics' initial name for the dog character, Dogbert. Microsoft emailed and calmly asked that in the future, the Loft hold off publishing details of security flaws until a patch was ready. "Maybe that's not a bad idea," Chris Wisopel said. Before that, if companies had complained about being taken by surprise, the Loft had given a canned response about caring for the users, not the vendors, Christian said. But he found it hard to argue that most users wouldn't be in better shape when a patch was out. So the group began negotiating with Microsoft and other companies. It would offer a month's notice before going public, while the companies asked for more time. Often they reached a compromise in the middle, and the current standard of coordinated disclosure began. Reading the disclosures made it easier for malicious hackers to learn most of what they needed to launch an attack based on the flaws. But everyone who patched right away would be safe. Without the disclosures, only the hackers who took the effort to reverse engineer the patches would have been able to launch the attacks. But there would have been less public awareness of the problems. Mudge and Wisopel, who wrote many of the advisories, became the most visible and articulate explainers of the researchers' side. "I wanted the Loft to be Consumer Reports and Rachel Carson and Ralph Nader," Mudge said. "That was my vision." Despite his youth, the group took Christian along for hangout sessions at New Hack City, home to the CDC servers. Mudge impressed him while playing quarters by rolling the coins off his nose before they bounced into a beer glass. As an MIT junior, Christian took a class on social issues and computing that turned out to be mostly about security. An early assignment was to look into buffer overflows, and the instructor put up a slide of one attributed to Dildog. "This is going to be much easier than I thought," Christian said to himself. The Loft invited him to join in late 1998, after Christian graduated, and it used money from the sale of its security tools to pay him to write the next version of its best-known program, the Loft Crack Password Breaker. It was a major improvement, brought in almost $500,000, and prompted the squad to make Christian their first full-time employee. "The point of Loft Crack was to get everyone out of their day jobs," he said. By the time Wisopel brought Christian in, the Loft was already famous. Wired and the Washington Post had written about it, as the advisories and tools drew attention to the downside of marketing-driven technology companies with no legal liability and little market punishment for the insecurity of their products. No one else had enough of an incentive to point out the emperor's lack of clothes. Inside Microsoft's biggest customer, the federal government, Richard Clark was getting nervous. Nobody seemed to be talking about the risks of hacking. A counterterrorism expert on the first President Bush's National Security Council, Clark was named the NSC's National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism by President Bill Clinton in 1998. Everything important in the country ran on software, most of it procured on the open market, and yet Clark kept reading about hackers having their way with it. Surely rival governments could be doing that in America as well. Clark's suspicions intensified after the war game exercise Eligible Receiver was run by the Defense Department in 1997. An NSA red team, tasked with breaking into Pentagon networks, ran roughshod over them using only conventional tools. Clark didn't know it at the time, but Moscow was already doing the same thing for real in an operation later discovered and dubbed Moonlight Maze. The success of Eligible Receiver prompted the Defense Department to set up the Joint Task Force Computer Network Defense, which would work on behalf of all branches of the military. Yet the leaders of the NSA were still telling Clark there wasn't much to worry about. He met with the CEOs of Microsoft, networking king Cisco, and database giant Oracle, and they said the same thing. They were all telling me their shit didn't stink, and I had a hard time reconciling the fact that Oracle and Microsoft and Cisco were all perfect with the fact that all these hacks were occurring, Clark said. It seemed obvious I needed to talk to the people doing the hacking, but they were probably criminals. So I asked, are there people like that who are not criminals? Clark talked to an FBI official who had transferred from the Boston office. He called back a few days later, said the Boston office knows this group of hackers that they vetted, they think they're clean, and when they have technical questions, they ask them stuff. Clark took a crew from the NSC up in early 1998. The Loft Gang suggested a drink at a bar called John Harvard's, then watched silently to see how many officials were there and how long they would sit before getting up to leave. After an hour, when they finally stood, Mudge said hello. After beers, the group invited the NSC team back to the loft. The men showed off a little of what they were working on. As they were leaving, Clark huddled with the other officials in the parking lot. A bit spooked, the hackers told Mudge to tell them it was impolite to whisper in their presence. He marched over and did so, demanding to know what the group was discussing. Everyone looked at Clark, who looked at Mudge frankly. We were saying we thought all this wouldn't be possible without some government support, he told the long hair. Have you gotten any? No, Mudge replied, then joked. If you have an offer, we'll listen. Clark paused, then laughed. Clark stayed in touch with Mudge afterward. Out of the group, Mudge was especially receptive. Some old-timers in CDC still instinctively dislike the government, or at least some of its laws, such as the Ham-Handed Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, or certain branches, namely the FBI. But Mudge was among those whose families had been paid by government dollars, and he had worked as a government contractor at BBN. He also felt that everyone should know what he knew. Perhaps the government would still make the wrong calls, he realized, but at least it wouldn't be out of ignorance. There was one last, less noble reason for playing ball. He was counting on people in the military being able to vouch for him if the FBI got overexcited and suddenly raided the loft. Should I find myself in court with a bunch of loft folks, brought up on charges of disturbing the peace or something? I wanted to be able to reach out and have a bunch of people with uniforms and a bunch of medals sitting up there as character witnesses, Mudge said. Clark was quietly preparing an order that would be known as Presidential Decision Directive 63 on critical infrastructure protection, which gave the government more authority to lead on private sector security measures. For ammunition in the intergovernmental turf battles and to head off complaining from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Clark called on his new ally in Boston, and shortly after, Senator Fred Thompson formally asked the seven current members of the loft to testify before Thompson's committee about threats from hacking. Mudge said they would only do it if they could use their hacker names, which was all that had been public about them up to that point, in order to protect their day jobs. Thompson agreed. The National Security Council had a message they wanted to get out, and this was an opportunity for the Loft to interact with the government without us being labeled as criminals, Mudge said. Everyone who didn't already own a suit bought or borrowed one, and they testified in May 1998. Chris Wisopel, Brian Hasek, Joe Grand, and three other members of the Loft sat with Mudge and his heavy metal hair in the middle. He was the only one present who was in the cult of the dead cow. Dan McMillan had moved west. John Lester had been displaced from the Loft, and future CDC member Christian Ryu wouldn't join the Loft for a few more months. If you're looking for computer security, then the internet is not the place to be, Mudge told the senators. How can we be expected to protect the system and the network when all of the seven individuals seated before you can tear down the foundation that the network was built upon? The most dramatic claim they made during the testimony was that they could take down the internet in 30 minutes through a problem they had found in the internet's routing procedure, Border Gateway Protocol. The Loft had already contacted the relevant manufacturers about the issue, Mudge said later. The senators present were far more alarmed by what they heard from the hackers than they had been by what the military and intelligence brass were saying. We were a visceral representation of what the adversarial view was, Wisopel said. The testimony made the Loft into the first group of rockstar hackers, and Mudge was the band leader. But even with cover from the government, he and others in the Loft, especially the newer and cleaner members like Wisopel and Christian, were nervous about their plans to not just improve the state of security, but earn a living in the process. They knew the Loft couldn't make things up or throw verbal hand grenades at the government or giant companies. For that, there was the bad cop, CDC, which played with seeming sinister. Both groups were mad that Microsoft had sidestepped back orifice without getting serious about security. It sent two messages: that back orifice was not a problem, and that to the extent some users felt it was, they could always just switch to Windows NT or later versions. The only way to fight back was to create a new version of back orifice that could beat the new operating system. That would show that Microsoft's main programs remained fundamentally broken because they did not give users a reliable way to know what was trustworthy on their machines. Christian was the best person to write the 1999 sequel to Back Orifice, and he had been drafted to CDC earlier that year. But though he was being paid by the Loft at the time, the Loft could not publish what they decided to call Back Orifice 2000 because that would have tied the Loft too closely to CDC and therefore to DEFCON and costumes and wrapping along with the air of drugs and crime. BO2K couldn't have been Loft because it already had stank on it, Mudge said. It had to remain separate from the Loft to avoid alienating the Richard Clarks of the world, who were potential Loft customers and partners. CDC would release BO2K with even more spectacle at DEF CON in July 1999 than it had created the year before. Though Windows NT had been put together much more carefully than Windows 98, the core problem remained. The computer handed off too much control to outside programs that were not signed digitally or otherwise attested to as authentic by Microsoft or the vendors of those programs. As a result, it was only a modest challenge for a hacker to get a malicious program running on a Windows machine, then hide the fact that it was there. CDC wanted to warn everyone that Microsoft's security setup was too complex and that users could be running something dangerous without knowing it. It wanted the company to require customers to verify the source and condition of the outside software so they could then decide what to trust. Our position should not be one of Microsoft bashing, but rather of user education, Christian wrote to the others in the group. Microsoft had screwed up, and it needs to take responsibility for putting so much power in the hands of the user. Christian's program was dramatically better than Josh Bookbinder's. Beyond the coding improvements, CDC wanted to settle an argument by Microsoft supporters and some hackers that Back Orifice was unsafe and might contain a back door for CDC, neither of which was true. This time, the group wanted to release the code, to make it open source. That would prove that there was nothing up CDC's sleeve. It would also up the stakes by making it easy for hackers to modify it, rendering antivirus programs, which look for identical versions of the things previously flagged as bad, far less effective. The Atlanta FBI office warned the Pentagon and other potential targets that the new version would be potentially more destructive and difficult to eradicate, and that all concerned should aggressively review and monitor their security measures. The Defense Department's Criminal Investigative Service looked into BO2K to help the military develop countermeasures, but did not pursue the matter beyond that. There would be more hacking, and that would put more pressure on Microsoft to make deeper fixes to its programs. As before, CDC drew the line at integrating any additional program that would take advantage of a software flaw to deliver and install the tool. The lack of such an exploit limited the group's moral culpability, CDC felt. The members were distributing a safe-cracking tool, but not the keys to the vault that held the safe. There was also a risk of legal liability. Courts had by then ruled that code was speech, and therefore almost no regulation could stop it from being written and distributed. But most serious programs also used encryption for communication. In the case of BO2K, the encryption would prevent data that was moving from an infected computer to the hacker's computer from being intercepted and deciphered. The Clinton administration had continued to clamp down on the export of strong cryptography over the objection of U.S.-based multinational technology firms. The government likened serious encryption to a weapon, albeit a defensive one, and made it subject to export controls. As is still the case, Washington wanted to maintain its ability to break codes used elsewhere. If strong encryption products go to other countries, that makes it harder. So Uncle Sam has used a variety of regulations to stop or hinder such exports. Christian did not want to get in trouble with the U.S. government. A lawyer was hired to take a look at the program and make sure they wouldn't get in export trouble. She advised them to put a little more effort into keeping the program out of enemy hands, at least until some pending court cases over similar issues were resolved. She told them to check whether the downloader's internet protocol addresses were in the U.S. and to have the locals promise not to transfer the program beyond the border. Those outside the U.S. got a version with less encryption. "The first rule of the activist is to not get caught," Kevin wrote to the list. "Federal time is bad time." In a new experiment, CDC decided to call BO2K a tool for remote administration in its press kit and documentation. In effect, it would be making the argument that the software was the most sophisticated tool for surreptitious electronic break-ins, while also being among the best tools ever made for corporate staffers to remotely monitor what was running on office computers and install new programs. While Symantec and Compaq charged more than $100 for remote tools, CDC would offer similar or better capabilities for free, with code the user could examine. If the group pulled it off, it would be dropping the pants of not just Microsoft, but also the established security companies, which CDC felt were getting fat on the internet stock market boom while peddling average products. The security establishment showed its true colors as launch date neared. Atlanta-based Internet Security Systems, which had first sold stock to the public in 1998, railed against the dangers of the impending BO2K to drum up its own business. But behind the scenes, it was sweet-talking CDC and asking for an advance copy of the program. That way, it could claim to be blocking BO2K before it came out. An ISS intermediary even offered cash, which was a terrible way to approach a group of volunteers who were convinced they had found the moral high ground. ISS is just flat-out sleazy in a lot of ways, Mudge said then. CDC exposed the offer and sent a reply it leaked to the press, saying, We are gladly willing to provide you with the software you desire if and only if you will, on exchange, grant us $1 million and a monster truck. Some ISS employees worked in the office through the DEF CON weekend, and they sent kids to the show floor to grab a CD and upload it at the first possible moment. Because CDC wanted maximum impact, it needed maximum press. For that to happen, it had to have a touch of evil, Kevin reasoned, the same way a punk or metal band craved condemnation. The hip press has to love us and the square press has to hate us for this to work. That's the eternal conflict in society to play off and ride, he wrote to the group. The day evangelist Pat Robertson says something positive about CDC is the day we're over. The conflict, the drama, is what makes this interesting and worth writing about. The insider appeal helped as well. When the group made jokes only other hackers got, it gave it street credibility and simultaneously impressed the outsiders, who realized CDC resonated with real hackers more than the people in suits did. But Kevin warned the group not to get cocky, reminding them that CDC had started by mocking the Legion of Doom and other self-serious coders. The point was to have fun and be useful. He wrote just before DEF CON, "If we fall for our own hype, that's the same pathetic retard bullshit that useless rock stars and movie stars fall for. When they can't handle the pressure and get some debilitating drug habit or become assholes, because they don't understand their role in a system." When the big day came, the presentation began with electronic music and the recorded voices of a farmer ordering his daughter to put a cow back in the barn and the girl refusing. With lights pulsating on the screen in the darkened room, Kevin rapped rhythmically and paced the stage for more than 5 minutes. It was the first full rock and roll hacker release, complete with stencil spotlights beaming the group's longhorn symbol. "CDC loves you," Kevin shouted, and once again led a call and response chant, "Dead, cow, kicks, ass." Even after the house lights came up, he went on, performing a mock faith healing and calling for amends from the thousands in the audience. Finally exhausted, he asked Sam Tweedyfish Anthony to introduce the rest of the 19 CDC members assembled on stage, by far the most in any one place. "This is Death Veggie, you all know him," Sam began. "The future of programming, Mr. Dildog." He went through them all, ending with the surprise reappearance of co-founder Bill Brown, wearing an old-fashioned suit. Then Sam said he needed to make two amendments to his year-old exhortation to go out and hack. "Pick a cause instead of hacking at random. And don't get caught." Christian then gave a straightforward demo of the core product and some of the available additions, stressing that the code was thoroughly customizable. The crowd repeatedly interrupted him with applause and oohs and ahs after he explained features, like the ability to delve into other machines connected to the target. After he and Josh fielded questions, the light suddenly went out again. Bill pulled off his tearaway suit from the front, revealing pasties on his chest. Mudge played rapid licks on the guitar and smashed it against an old PC. Christian had burned advanced copies of BO2K onto CDs with a machine owned by Ninja Strike Force member Limor Freed, whom he was dating. Unfortunately, her machine had been infected with a virus known as Chernobyl, which spread to the CDs for the press and those the group brought to Las Vegas to toss to the crowd, which included diving ISS employees. Once hackers at DEF CON uploaded it to the net, someone detected the virus and cried foul. CDC once again faced suspicions of hacking fellow hackers. CDC admitted the screw-up and apologized. Fortunately, the version available for download from the CDC website was clean all along. Christian was so young and had come to CDC so quickly that he didn't have connections to criminals like some of the others. When people asked him whether malicious hackers would use his creation for crime, Christian said he didn't think so. In retrospect, that was implausibly naive. Though far from malicious himself, he said he wasn't at the pious extreme either, but a question asker. I am not completely white hat, because I wasn't trying to secure the world, but to raise awareness. Kevin's hometown paper saw nothing but black hats, and Swamp Rat couldn't have been happier. We prefer to call it what it is, organized crime and terrorism, the Lubbock Avalanche Journal declared in an editorial condemning BO2K. BO2K is a weapon. It has no useful purpose other than to attack and destroy the property of an individual or corporation. We believe that it is time for an aggressive campaign against organized hacking. We find it disgraceful that a weapon like BO2K can be given in an in-your-face public release by CDC without any real fear by the group or its members of being held accountable. As Kevin recapped it for friends, the paper was practically calling us godless commies and a threat to the American way of life and their daughter's virginity. It was fucking beautiful. Security companies didn't go as far as all that, but they generally categorized BO2K as a virus. Finland-based F-Secure noted that it was likely to be used by hackers, especially since the program went to such lengths to run without detection and to avoid being deleted. It kept changing its process identifier and created new processes in case one was killed. The best-known cryptography expert of the era, Bruce Schneier, gave it a qualified thumbs up. He wrote that it was useful for systems administrators. He also acknowledged that miscreants would love it, since BO2K was one of the coolest hacking tools ever developed. Schneier openly addressed the philosophical game that CDC was playing, and he declared it a winner. Since it is not distributed by a respectable company, it cannot be trusted. Since it was written by hackers, it is evil. Since its malicious uses are talked about more, its benevolent uses are ignored. That's wrong, Schneier wrote on his blog. He said that Microsoft security was virtually non-existent in Windows 95 and 98, and that a user would have to make more than 300 adjustments from the defaults in Windows NT to make it safe. Microsoft had created the danger, and what BackOrifice has done is made mainstream computer users aware of the danger. Maybe the world would have been safer had they not demonstrated the danger so graphically, but I am not sure. Schneier wrote, Microsoft only responds to security threats if they are demonstrated. Explain the threat in an academic paper and Microsoft denies it. Release a hacking tool like BackOrifice and suddenly they take the vulnerability seriously. Some of the most enthusiastic support came from those high up in government and defense contractors. One Lockheed Martin expert wrote to a security mailing list that the fanfare around BackOrifice had prompted him to look into the prevalence of Trojan programs, which allow computer takeovers, and that he had been stunned to find more than 10 in quiet circulation. He said the new noise around BO2K was the shock treatment that network administrators needed. If your security is not strong enough to stop script kiddies with publicly available tools, then you have no hope of securing your network from professionals waging war, he wrote. Wake up, people. It's going to get much, much worse. In public, Microsoft again poo-pooed the issues, even after hackers posted videos of themselves taking over strangers' machines. In private, it panicked once more. An executive asked security worker Rob Whitey Beck, a friend of Carrie Campbell, to have her bring in a video of the DEF CON presentation. Carrie wanted to help Microsoft do better, so she walked across the street to campus, met the executive, and then gasped as he took the CD she handed him and popped it into his office computer. Wait, she said, before he could type run. Do you have a sandboxed machine? She meant one where a malicious program couldn't move to other computers. The man stared at her. You're not putting that CD into a machine connected to the network, are you? Sure, he said. Really? Don't you have a separate box you can put that into? another blank look. So let me get this right. You have a member of an internationally famous hacker group that just released a tool to help people defeat Microsoft security sitting in front of you. You don't know her at all, and you're putting a homemade CD she handed you directly into your machine? Please tell me you at least are running an antivirus tool against it. He wasn't. All the noise still hadn't fully penetrated Microsoft, but it had finally gotten through to Microsoft customers, especially banks, who pressed the company to make serious changes or risk losing them all to Linux. After BO2K, Microsoft did more to promote the use of digital signatures that established who was standing behind a program. File integrity became a big thing too, Beck said, with software that checked that a program had not been altered. Security budgets rose across the industry as companies spent more on deeper security research and bought firewalls and intrusion detection systems. Pulling off feats like the Orifice launches 2 years in a row cemented CDC's position in security culture as the internet boom was peaking. In a format later adopted by Reddit for its AMAs, the leading tech discussion site Slashdot arranged that fall for CDC to answer reader questions under their various handles. Amid a lot of joking and posed crudeness, they articulated quite a few beliefs and goals for security that had many tech industry readers nodding. They especially wanted software companies to put more thought, effort, and money into user safety and privacy, even if they did not consider themselves to be in the security business. Make security concerns and security audits an integral part of the development process rather than an afterthought, urged Sam. Added Christian, encrypt everything. Eliminate HTTP and go right to HTTPS everywhere. About 19 years later, Google's Chrome browser would finally begin warning users who reached HTTP sites that they were not secure. Since they all had day jobs, they laughed off suggestions that they distribute a greatly expanded suite of software. But they actually had more ambition than they let on. They had already begun following a path proposed by the member, urging them to use their notoriety for the greatest possible good. Oxblood Ruffin.